I shrug again, but I don't feel casual about it. Amar was the first person who noticed that I was divergent, and he helped me to hide it. But he couldn't hide his own divergence, and that killed him. She touches my arm lightly, but doesn't say anything. I shift, uncomfortable. See, I say. Too many bad memories here. I'm ready to leave. I feel empty. Not because of sadness, but because of relief. All the tension flowing out of me. Evelyn is in that city. And Marcus. And all the grief and nightmares and bad memories. And the factions that kept me trapped inside one version of myself. I squeeze Triss's hand. Look, I say, pointing at a distant cluster of buildings. There's the abnegation sector. She smiles, but her eyes are glassy, like a dormant part of her is fighting its way out, spilling over. The train hisses over the rails. A tear drops down Triss's cheek, and the city disappears into the darkness.
Chapter 11. Triss. The train slows down when we get closer to the fence, a signal from the driver that we should get off soon. Tobias and I sit in the doorway of the car as it moves lazily over the tracks. He puts his arm around me and touches his nose to my hair, taking a breath. I look at him, at the collarbone peeking out from the neck of his t-shirt, at the faint curl of his lip, and I feel something heating up inside me.
What are you thinking about?
He says into my ear softly. I jerk to attention. I look at him all the time, but not always like that. I feel like he just caught me doing something embarrassing. Nothing. Why?
No reason.
He pulls me closer to his side, and I rest my head on his shoulder, taking deep breaths of the cool air. It still smells like summer, like grass baking in the heat of the sun. It looks like we're getting close to the fence, I say. I can tell because the buildings are disappearing, leaving just fields, dotted with the rhythmic glow of lightning bugs. Behind me, Caleb sits near the other door, hugging his knees. His eyes find mine at just the wrong moment, and I want to scream into the darkest part of him so he can finally hear me, finally understand what he did to me. But instead, I just hold his stare, until he can't take it anymore, and he looks away. I stand, using the handle to steady me, and Tobias and Caleb do the same. At first, Caleb tries to stand behind us, but Tobias pushes him forward, right up to the edge of the car.
You first, on my mark, he says. And go.
He gives Caleb a push, just enough to get him off the car floor, and my brother disappears. Tobias goes next, leaving me alone in the train car. It's stupid to miss a thing when there are so many people to miss instead. But I miss this train already, and all the others that carried me through the city, my city, after I was brave enough to ride them. I brush my fingers over the car wall, just once, and then jump. The train is moving so slowly that I overcompensate with my landing. Too used to running off the momentum, and I fall. The dry grass scrapes my palms, and I push myself to my feet, searching the darkness for Tobias and Caleb. Before I find them, I hear Christina.
Triss!
She and Uriah come toward me. He is holding a flashlight, and he looks far more alert than he did this afternoon, which is a good sign. Behind them are more lights, more voices.
Did your brother make it? Uriah says.
Yeah. Finally, I see Tobias, his hand gripping Caleb's arm, coming toward us.
Not sure why an erudite like you can't get it through his head, Tobias is saying, but you aren't going to be able to outrun me.
He's right, says Uriah. Force fast. Not as fast as me, but definitely faster than a nose like you. Christina laughs.
A what?
Nose. Uriah touches the side of his nose. It's a play on words. Nose, with a K. Knowledge, erudite. Get it?
It's like stiff. The Dauntless have the weirdest slang. Pansy cake, nose. Is there a term for the candor? Of course. Uriah grins.
Jerks.
Christina shoves Uriah, hard, making him drop the flashlight. Tobias, laughing, leads us to the rest of the group, standing a few feet away. Tori waves her flashlight in the air to get everyone's attention, then says,
All right, Johanna and the trucks will be about a 10-minute walk from here, so let's get going. And if I hear a word from anyone, I will beat you senseless. We're not out yet.
We move closer together like sections of a tightened shoelace. Tori walks a few feet in front of us, and from the back, in the dark, she reminds me of Evelyn. Her limbs lean and wiry, her shoulders back, so sure of herself it's almost frightening. By the light of the flashlights, I can just make out the tattoo of a hawk on the back of her neck. The first thing I spoke to her about when she administered my aptitude test. She told me it was a symbol of a fear she had overcome, a fear of the dark. I wonder if that fear still creeps up on her now. Though she worked so hard to face it, I wonder if fears ever really go away, or if they just lose their power over us. She moves farther away from us by the minute, her pace more like a jog than a walk. She is eager to leave, to escape this place where her brother was murdered, and she rose to prominence only to be thwarted by a factionless woman who wasn't supposed to be alive. She is so far ahead that when the shots go off, I only see her flashlight fall, not her body.
Split up!
Tobias's voice roars over the sound of our cries, our chaos.
Run!
I search in the dark for his hand, but I don't find it. I grab the gun Uriah gave me before we left and hold it out for my body, ignoring the way my throat tightens at the feel of it. I can't run into the night. I need light. I sprint in the direction of Tori's body, of her fallen flashlight. I hear but do not hear the gunshots, and the shouting, and the running footsteps. I hear but do not hear my heartbeat. I crouch next to the shaft of light she dropped and pick up the flashlight, intending to just grab it and keep running. But in its glow, I see her face. It shines with sweat, and her eyes roll beneath her eyelids, like she is searching for something, but is too tired to find it. One of the bullets found her stomach, and the other found her chest. There is no way she will recover from this. I may be angry with her for fighting me in Janine's laboratory, but she's still Tori, the woman who guarded the secret of my divergence. My throat tightens as I remember following her into the aptitude test room, my eyes on her hawk tattoo. Her eyes shift in my direction and focus on me, her eyebrows furrow, but she doesn't speak. I shift the flashlight into the crook of my thumb and reach for her hand to squeeze her sweaty fingers. I hear someone approaching, and I aim flashlight and gun in the same direction. The beam hits a woman wearing a factionless armband with a gun pointed at my head. I fire, clenching my teeth so hard they squeak. The bullet hits the woman in the stomach, and she screams, firing blindly into the night. I look back down at Tori, and her eyes are closed, her body still. Pointing my flashlight at the ground, I sprint away from her and from the woman I just shot. My legs ache, and my lungs burn. I don't know where I'm going, if I'm running into danger or away from it, but I keep running as long as I can. Finally, I see a light in the distance. At first, I think it's another flashlight, but as I draw closer, I realize it is larger and steadier than a flashlight. It's a headlight. I hear an engine and crouch in the tall grass to hide, switching my flashlight off and keeping my gun ready. The truck slows, and I hear a voice. Tori? It sounds like Christina. The truck is red and rusted, an Amity vehicle. I straighten, pointing the light at myself so she'll see me. The truck stops a few feet ahead of me, and Christina leaps out of the passenger seat, throwing her arms around me. I replay it in my mind to make it real. Tori's body falling,
the factionless woman's hands covering her stomach. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel real.
Thank God, Christina says. Get in. We're going to find Tori.
Tori's dead, I say plainly, and the word, dead, makes it real for me. I wipe tears from my cheeks with the heels of my hands and struggle to control my shuddering breaths. I shot the woman who killed her.
What?
Johanna sounds frantic. She leans over from the driver's seat.
What did you say?
Tori's gone, I say. I saw it happen. Johanna's expression is shrouded by her hair. She presses her next breath out.
Well, let's find the others then.
I get into the truck. The engine roars as Johanna presses the gas pedal, and we bump over the grass in search of the others.
Did you see any of them? I say.
A few. Kara, Uriah. Johanna shakes her head. No one else. I wrap my hand around the door handle and squeeze. If I had tried harder to find Tobias, if I hadn't stopped for Tori. What if Tobias didn't make it?
I'm sure they're all right, Johanna says. That boy of yours knows how to take care of himself.
I nod, without conviction. Tobias can take care of himself. But in an attack, surviving is an accident. It doesn't take skill to stand in a place where no bullets find you, or to fire into the dark and hit a man you didn't see. It is all luck, or providence, depending on what you believe. And I don't know, have never known, exactly what I believe.
He's all right. He's all right. He's all right. Tobias is all right.
My hands tremble, and Christina squeezes my knee. Johanna steers us toward the rendezvous point, where she saw Uriah and Kara. I watch the speedometer needle climb, then hold steady at 75. We jostle one another in the cab, thrown this way and that way by the uneven ground.
There!
Christina points. There is a cluster of lights ahead of us, some just pinpricks, like flashlights, and others round, like headlights. We pull up close. And I see him. Tobias sits on the hood of the other truck, his arms soaked with blood. Kara stands in front of him with a first aid kit. Caleb and Peter sit on the grass a few feet away. Before Johanna has stopped the truck completely, I open the door and get out, running toward him. Tobias stands up, ignoring Kara's orders to stay put, and we collide, his uninjured arm wrapping around my back and lifting me off my feet. His back is wet with sweat, and when he kisses me, he tastes like salt. All the knots of tension inside me come apart at once. I feel, just for a moment, like I am remade, like I am brand new. He's all right. We're out of the city. He's all right.
Chapter 12. Tobias. My arm throbs like a second heartbeat from the bullet graze. Triss's knuckles brush mine as she lifts her hand to point at something on our right. A series of long, low buildings lit by blue emergency lamps.
What are those? Triss says.
The other greenhouses, Johanna says. They don't require much manpower, but we grow and raise things in large quantities there. Animals, raw material for fabric, wheat, and so on. Their panes glow in the starlight, obscuring the treasures I imagine to be inside them. Small plants with berries dangling from their branches. Rows of potato plants buried in the earth.
You don't show them to visitors, I say.
We never saw them.
Amity keeps a number of secrets, Johanna says, and she sounds proud.
The road ahead of us is long and straight, marked with cracks and swollen patches. Alongside it are gnarled trees, broken lamp posts, old power lines. Every so often there is an isolated square of sidewalk with weeds forcing their way through the concrete, or a pile of rotting wood, a collapsed dwelling.
The more time I spend thinking about this landscape that every dauntless patrol was told was normal, the more I see an old city rising up around me, the buildings lower than the ones we left behind, but just as numerous. An old city that was transformed into empty land for the Amity to farm. In other words, an old city that was razed, burned to cinders and crushed into the ground, even the roads disappearing, the earth left to run wild over the wreckage. I put my hand out the window and the wind wraps around my fingers like locks of hair. When I was very young, my mother pretended she could shape things from the wind, and she would give them to me to use, like hammers and nails, or swords, or roller skates. It was a game we played in the evenings on the front lawn before Marcus got home. It took away our dread. In the bed of the truck behind us are Caleb, Christina, and Uriah. Christina and Uriah sit close enough for their shoulders to touch, but they are looking in opposite directions, more like strangers than friends. Just behind us is another truck, driven by Robert, which carries Kara and Peter. Tori was supposed to be with them. The thought makes me feel hollow, empty. She administered my aptitude test. She made me think for the first time that I could leave abnegation, that I had to. I feel like I owe her something, and she died before I could give it to her. "This is it," Johanna says. "The outer limit of the Dauntless Patrols." No fence or wall marks the divide between the Amity compound and the outer world. But I remember monitoring the Dauntless Patrols from the control room, making sure they didn't go farther than the limit, which is marked by a series of signs with X's on them. The patrols were structured so that the trucks would run out of gas if they went too far, a delicate system of checks and balances that preserved our safety and theirs. And now I realized the secret the abnegation kept. "Have they ever gone past the limit?" says Triss. "A few times," says Johanna. "It was our responsibility to deal with that situation when it came up." Triss gives her a look, and she shrugs. "Every faction has a serum," Johanna says. "The Dauntless serum gives hallucinated realities. Kander's gives the truth. Amity's gives peace. Erudite's gives death." At this, Triss visibly shudders. But Johanna continues as if it didn't happen. "And abnegations resets memory." "Resets memory?" "Like Amanda Ritter's memory," I say. "She said there are many things I am happy to forget, remember?" "Yes, exactly," says Johanna. "The Amity are charged with administering the abnegation serum to anyone who goes out past the limit. Just enough to make them forget the experience. I'm sure some of them have slipped past us, but not many." We are silent then. I turn the information over and over in my mind. There is something deeply wrong with taking a person's memories, even though I know it was necessary to keep our city safe for as long as it needed to be. I feel it in the pit of my stomach. Take a person's memories, and you change who they are. Swelling inside me is the feeling that I am about to jump out of my own skin, because the farther we get outside the outer limit of the Dauntless Patrols, the closer we get to seeing what lies outside the only world I've ever known. I'm terrified and thrilled and confused and 100 different things at once. I see something up ahead of us in the light of the early morning and grab Triss's hand. "Look," I say.
Chapter 13. Triss. The world beyond ours is full of roads and dark buildings and collapsing power lines. There is no life in it, as far as I can see. No movement, no sound but the wind and my own footsteps. It's like the landscape is an interrupted sentence, one side dangling in the air, unfinished, and the other, a completely different subject. On our side of that sentence is empty land, grass and stretches of road. On the other side are two concrete walls with half a dozen sets of train tracks between them. Up ahead, there is a concrete bridge built across the walls. And framing the tracks are buildings, wood and brick and glass, their windows dark, trees growing around them, so wild their branches have grown together. A sign on the right says 90.
What do we do now?
Uriah asks.
We follow the tracks, I say, but quietly, so only I hear it.
We get out of the trucks at the divide between our world and theirs, whoever they are. Robert and Johanna say a brief goodbye, turn the trucks around, and drive back into the city. I watch them go. I can't imagine coming this far and then turning back. But I guess there are things they have to do in the city. Johanna still has an Allegiant rebellion to organize. The rest of us, me, Tobias, Caleb, Peter, Christina, Uriah, and Kara, set out with our meager possessions along the railroad tracks. The tracks are not like the ones in the city. They are polished and sleek, and instead of boards running perpendicular to their path, there are sheets of textured metal. Up ahead, I see one of the trains that runs along them, abandoned near the wall. It is metal plated on the top and front, like a mirror, with tinted windows all along the side. When we draw closer, I see rows of benches inside it, with maroon cushions on them. People must not jump on and off these trains. Tobias walks behind me, on one of the rails, his arms held out from his sides to maintain his balance. The others are spread out over the tracks, Peter and Caleb near one wall, Kara near the other. No one talks much, except to point out something new, a sign or a building, or a hint of what this world was like, when there were people in it. The concrete walls alone hold my attention. They are covered with strange pictures of people, with skin so smooth they hardly look like people anymore, or colorful bottles with shampoo or conditioner, or vitamins, or unfamiliar substances inside them. Words I don't understand. Vodka. And Coca-Cola. And energy drink. The colors and shapes and words and pictures are so garish, so abundant, that they are mesmerizing. Tris. Tobias puts his hand on my shoulder, and I stop. He tilts his head and says, "Do you hear that?" I hear footsteps, and the quiet voices of our companions. I hear my own breaths, and his. But running beneath them is a quiet rumble, inconsistent in its intensity. It sounds like an engine. "Everyone stop!" I shout. To my surprise, everyone does, even Peter, and we gather together in the center of the tracks. I see Peter draw his gun and hold it up, and I do the same, both hands joined together to steady it, remembering the ease with which I used to lift it. That ease is gone now. Something appears around the bend up ahead. A black truck, but larger than any truck I've ever seen. Large enough to hold more than a dozen people in its covered bed. I shudder. The truck bumps over the tracks and comes to a stop 20 feet away from us. I can see the man driving it. He has dark skin and long hair that is in a knot at the back of his head. "God," Tobias says, and his hands tighten around his own gun. A woman gets out of the front seat. She looks to be around Johanna's age, her skin patterned with dense freckles, and her hair so dark it's almost black. She hops to the ground and puts up both hands, so we can see that she isn't armed. "Hello," she says, and smiles nervously. "My name is Zoe. This is Amar." She jerks her head to the side to indicate the driver, who has gotten out of the truck, too. "Amar is dead," Tobias says. "No, I'm not." "Come on, four," Amar says. Tobias's face is tight with fear. I don't blame him. It's not every day you see someone you care about come back from the dead. The faces of all the people I've lost flash into my mind. Lynn, Marlene, Will, Al, my father, my mother. What if they're still alive, like Amar? What if the curtain that separates us is not death, but a chain-link fence and some land? I can't stop myself from hoping, foolish as it is.
We work for the same organization that founded your city, Zoe says as she glares at Amar. The same organization Edith Pryor came from. And, she reaches into her pocket and takes out a partially crumpled photograph. She holds it out, and then her eyes find mine in the crowd of people and guns. I think you should look at this, Triss, she says. I'll step forward and leave it on the ground, then back up. All right?
She knows my name. My throat tightens with fear. How does she know my name? And not just my name, my nickname, the name I chose when I joined Dauntless.
All right, I say, but my voice is hoarse, so the words barely escape.
Zoe steps forward, sets the photograph down on the train tracks, then moves back to her original position. I leave the safety of our numbers and crouch near the photograph, watching her the whole time. Then I back up, photograph in hand. It shows a row of people in front of a chain-link fence, their arms slung around one another's shoulders and backs. I see a child version of Zoe, recognizable by her freckles, and a few people I don't recognize. I am about to ask her what the point of me looking at this picture is, when I recognize the young woman with dull blonde hair, tied back, and a wide smile. My mother. What is my mother doing next to these people? Something. Grief, pain, longing, squeezes my chest.
There is a lot to explain, Zoe says. But this isn't really the best place to do it. We'd like to take you to our headquarters. It's a short drive from here.
Still holding up his gun, Tobias touches my wrist, with his free hand, guiding the photograph closer to his face.
That's your mother?
He asks me.
It's Mom?
Caleb says. He pushes past Tobias to see the picture over my shoulder.
Yes, I say to both of them.
Think we should trust them? Tobias says to me in a low voice. Zoe doesn't look like a liar, and she doesn't sound like one either. And if she knows who I am, and knew how to find us here, it's probably because she has some form of access to the city. Which means she is probably telling the truth about being with the group that Edith Pryor came from. And then there's Amar, who is watching every movement Tobias makes.
We came out here because we wanted to find these people, I say. We have to trust someone, don't we?
Or else we're just walking around in a wasteland, possibly starving to death. Tobias releases my wrist and lowers his gun. I do the same. The others follow suit slowly, with Christina putting hers down last.
Wherever we go, we have to be free to leave at any time, Christina says. Okay?
Zoe places her hand on her chest, right over her heart.
You have my word.
I hope, for all our sakes, that her word is worth having.
Chapter 14. Tobias. I stand on the edge of the truck bed, holding the structure that supports the cloth cover. I want this new reality to be a simulation that I could manipulate if only I could make sense of it. But it's not, and I can't make sense of it. Amar is alive. Adapt was one of his favorite commands during my initiation. Sometimes he yelled it so often that I would dream it. It woke me like an alarm clock, requiring more of me than I could provide. Adapt. Adapt faster, adapt better, adapt to things that no man should have to. Like this, leaving a wholly formed world and discovering another one. Or this, discovering that your dead friend is actually alive and driving the truck you're riding in. Triss sits behind me on the bench that wraps around the truck bed, the creased photo in her hands. Her fingers hover over her mother's face, almost touching it, but not quite. Christina sits on one side of her, and Caleb is on the other. She must be letting him stay just to see the photograph. Her entire body recoils from him, pressing into Christina's side.
That's your mom? Christina says. Triss and Caleb both nod. She's so young there. Pretty, too, Christina adds. Yes, she is. Was, I mean. I expect Triss to sound sad as she replies, like she's aching at the memory of her mother's fading beauty. Instead, her voice is nervous, her lips pursed in anticipation. I hope that she isn't brewing false hope. Let me see it, Caleb says, stretching his hand out to his sister. Silently, and without really looking at him, she passes him the photograph. I turn back to the world we are driving away from, the end of the train tracks, the huge expanses of field, and in the distance, the hub, barely visible in the haze that covers the city's skyline. It's a strange feeling seeing it from this place, like I can still touch it if I stretch my hand far enough, though I have traveled so far away from it. Peter moves toward the edge of the truck bed next to me, holding the canvas to steady himself. The train tracks curve away from us now, and I can't see the fields anymore. The walls on either side of us gradually disappear as the land flattens out, and I see buildings everywhere. Some small like the abnegation houses, and some wide like city buildings turned on their sides. Trees, overgrown and huge, grow beyond the cement fixtures intended to keep them enclosed, their roots sprawling over the pavement. Perched on the edge of one rooftop is a row of blackbirds like the ones tattooed on Triss's collarbone. As the truck passes, they squawk and scatter into the air. This is a wild world. Just like that, it's too much for me to bear, and I have to back up and sit on one of the benches. I cradle my head in my hands, keeping my eyes shut so I can't take in any new information. I feel Triss's strong arm across my back, pulling me sideways into her narrow frame. My hands are numb. Just focus on what's right here, right now, Kara says from across the truck. Like how the truck is moving. It'll help. I try. I think about how hard the bench is beneath me, and how the truck always vibrates, even on flat ground, buzzing in my bones. I detect its tiny movements, left and right, forward and back, and absorb each bounce as it rolls over the rails. I focus until everything goes dark around us, and I don't feel the passage of time or the panic of discovery. I feel only our movement over the earth. You should probably look around now, Triss says, and she sounds weak. Christina and Uriah stand where I stood, peering around the edge of the canvas wall. I look over their shoulders to see what we're driving toward. There is a tall fence stretching wide across the landscape, which looks empty compared to the densely packed buildings I saw before I sat down. The fence has vertical black bars with pointed ends that bend outward, as if to skewer anyone who might try to climb over it. A few feet past it is another fence, this one chain link like the one around the city, with barbed wire looped over the top. I hear a loud buzz coming from the second fence, an electric charge. People walk the space between them carrying guns that look a little like our paintball guns, but far more lethal, powerful pieces of machinery. A sign on the first fence reads, Bureau of Genetic Welfare. I hear Amar's voice speaking to the armed guards, but I don't know what he's saying. A gate in the first fence opens to admit us, and then a gate in the second. Beyond the two fences is order. As far as I can see, there are low buildings separated by trimmed grass and fledgling trees. The roads that connect them are well maintained and well marked, with arrows pointing to various destinations. Greenhouses straight ahead, security outpost left, officers' residences right, compound main straight ahead. I get up and lean around the truck to see the compound, half my body hanging over the road. The Bureau of Genetic Welfare isn't tall, but it's still huge, wider than I can see. A mammoth of glass and steel and concrete. Behind the compound are a few tall towers with bulges at the top. I don't know why, but I think of the control room when I see them, and wonder if that's what they are. Aside from the guards between the fences, there are a few people outside. Those who are stop to watch us,
but we drive away so quickly I don't see their expressions. The truck stops before a set of double doors, and Peter is the first to jump down. The rest of us spill out on the pavement behind him, and we are shoulder to shoulder, standing so close I can hear how fast everyone is breathing. In the city, we were divided by faction, by age, by history. But here all those divisions fall away. We are all we have.
Here we go, mutters Triss, as Zoe and Amar approach.
Here we go, I say to myself.
Welcome to the compound, says Zoe. This building used to be O'Hare Airport, one of the busiest airports in the country. Now it's the headquarters of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare, or just the Bureau, as we call it around here. It's an agency of the United States government. I feel my face going slack. I know all the words she's saying, except I'm not sure what an airport or United States is, but they don't make sense to me altogether. I'm not the only one who looks confused. Peter raises both eyebrows as if asking a question. Sorry, she says. I keep forgetting how little you all know. I believe it's your fault if we don't know anything, not ours, Peter points out. I should rephrase. Zoe smiles gently. I keep forgetting how little information we provided you with. An airport is a hub for air travel, and... Air travel? Says Christina, incredulous.
One of the technological developments that wasn't necessary for us to know about when we were inside the city was air travel, says Amar. It's safe, fast, and amazing.
Wow, says Triss.
She looks excited. I, however, think of speeding through the air high above the compound and feel like I might throw up.
Anyway, when the experiments were first developed, the airport was converted into this compound so that we could monitor the experiments from a distance, Zoe says. I'm going to walk you to the control room to meet David, the leader of the Bureau. You will see a lot of things you don't understand, but it may be best to get some preliminary explanations before you start asking me about them. So, take note of the things you want to learn more about, and feel free to ask me or Amar later. She starts toward the entrance, and the doors part for her, pulled open by two armed guards who smile in greeting as she passes them. The contrast between the friendly greeting and the weapons propped against their shoulders is almost humorous. The guns are huge, and I wonder how they feel to shoot, if you can feel the deadly power in them just by curling your finger around the trigger. Cool air rushes over my face as I walk into the compound. Windows arch high above my head, letting in pale light. But that is the most appealing part about the place. The tile floor is dull with dirt and age, and the walls are gray and blank. Ahead of us is a sea of people and machinery, with a sign over it that says, Security Checkpoint. I don't understand why they need so much security if they're already protected by two layers of fence, one of which is electrified and a few layers of guards, but this is not my world to question. No, this is not my world at all. Triss touches my shoulder and points down the long entryway. Look at that. Standing at the far end of the room, outside the security checkpoint, is a huge block of stone with a glass apparatus suspended above it. It's a clear example of the things we will see here that we don't understand. I also don't understand the hunger in Triss's eyes, devouring everything around us as if it alone can sustain her. Sometimes I feel like we are the same, but sometimes, like right now, I feel the separation between our personalities like I've just run into a wall. Christina says something to Triss and they both grin. Everything I hear is muffled and distorted. Are you all right? Kara asks me. Yeah, I say automatically. You know, it would be perfectly logical for you to be panicking right now, she says. No need to continually insist upon your unshakable masculinity. My what? She smiles and I realize that she was joking. All the people at the security checkpoint step aside, forming a tunnel for us to walk through. Ahead of us, Zoe announces, Weapons are not allowed inside this facility, but if you leave them at the security checkpoint, you can pick them up as you exit, if you choose to do so. After you drop them off, we'll go through the scanners and be on our way.
That woman is irritating,
Kara says. What? I say, why? She can't separate herself from her own knowledge, she says as she draws her weapon. She keeps saying things like they're obvious when they are not, in fact, obvious. You're right, I say without conviction. That is irritating. Ahead of me, I see Zoe putting her gun into a gray container and then walking into a scanner. It is a man-sized box with a tunnel through the middle, just wide enough for a body. I draw my own gun, which is heavy with unused bullets, and put it in the container the security guard holds out to me, where all the others' guns are. I watch Zoe go through the scanner, then Amar, Peter, Caleb, Kara, and Christina. As I stand at the edge of it, at the walls that will squeeze my body between them, I feel the beginnings of panic again, the numb hands and the tight chest. The scanner reminds me of the wooden box that traps me in my fear landscape, squeezing my bones together. I cannot, will not panic here. I force my feet to move into the scanner and stand in the middle where all the others stood. I hear something moving in the walls on either side of me, and then there's a high-pitched beep. I shudder, and all I can see is the guard's hand motioning me forward. It is now okay to escape. I stumble out of the scanner, and the air opens up around me. Kara gives me a pointed look but doesn't say anything. When Triss takes my hand after going through the scanner herself, I barely feel it. I remember going through my fear landscape with her, our bodies pressed together in the wooden box that enclosed us, my palm against her chest feeling her heartbeat. It's enough to ground me in reality again. Once Uriah is through, Zoe waves us forward again. Beyond the security checkpoint, the facility is not as dingy as it was before. The floors are still tile, but they are polished to perfection, and there are windows everywhere. Down one long hallway, I see rows of lab tables and computers, and it reminds me of Erudite headquarters, but it's brighter here, and nothing seems to be hidden. Zoe leads us down a darker passageway on the right. As we walk past people, they stop to watch, and I feel their eyes on me like little beams of heat, making me warm from throat to cheeks. We walk for a long time deeper into the compound, and then Zoe stops, facing us. Behind her is a large circle of blank screens, like moths circling a flame. People within the circle sit at low desks, typing furiously on still more screens, these ones facing out instead of in. It's a control room, but it's out in the open, and I'm not sure what they're observing here, since all the screens are dark. Clustered around the screens that face in are chairs and benches and tables, like people gather here to watch at their leisure. A few feet in front of the control room is an older man wearing a smile and a dark blue uniform, just like all the others. When he sees us approaching, he spreads his hands as if to welcome us. David, I assume. This, the man says, is what we've waited for since the very beginning.
Chapter 15. Triss. I take the photograph from my pocket. The man in front of me, David, is in it, next to my mother. His face a little smoother, his middle a little trimmer. I cover my mother's face with my fingertip. All the hope growing inside me has withered. If my mother, or my father, or my friends were still alive, they would have been waiting by the doors for our arrival. I should have known better than to think what happened with Amar, whatever it was, could happen again. My name is David. As Zoe probably told you already, I am the leader of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. I'm going to do my best to explain things, David says. The first thing you should know is that the information Edith Pryor gave you is only partly true. At the name Pryor, his eyes settle on me. My body shakes with anticipation. Ever since I saw that video, I've been desperate for answers, and I'm about to get them. She provided only as much information as you needed to meet the goals of our experiments, says David. And in many cases, that meant oversimplifying, omitting, and even outright falsehood. Now that you are here,
There is no need for any of those things.
You all keep talking about experiments, Tobias says.
What experiments?
Yes, well, I was getting to that.
David looks at Amar.
Where did they start when they explained it to you?
Doesn't matter where you start. You can't make it easier to take, Amar says, picking at his cuticles.
David considers this for a moment, then clears his throat.
A long time ago, the United States government...
The United what? Uriah asks.
It's a country, says Amar. A large one. It has specific borders and its own governing body, and we're in the middle of it right now. We can talk about it later. Go ahead, sir.
David presses his thumb into his palm and massages his hand, clearly disconcerted by all the interruptions. He begins again.
A few centuries ago, the government of this country became interested in enforcing certain desirable behaviors in its citizens. There had been studies that indicated that violent tendencies could be partially traced to a person's genes. A gene called the murder gene was the first of these. But there were quite a few more. Genetic predispositions toward cowardice, dishonesty, low intelligence. All the qualities, in other words, that ultimately contribute to a broken society.
We were taught that the factions were formed to solve a problem. The problem of our flawed natures. Apparently, the people David is describing, whoever they were, believed in that problem too. I know so little about genetics. Just what I can see passed down from parent to child, in my face and in friends' faces. I can't imagine isolating a gene from murder, or cowardice, or dishonesty. Those things seem too nebulous to have a concrete location in a person's body. But I'm not a scientist.
Obviously, there are quite a few factors that determine personality, including a person's upbringing and experiences, David continues. But, despite the peace and prosperity that had reigned in this country for nearly a century, it seemed advantageous to our ancestors to reduce the risk of these undesirable qualities showing up in our population by correcting them. In other words, by editing humanity. That's how the genetic manipulation experiment was born. It takes several generations for any kind of genetic manipulation to manifest, but people were selected from the general population in large numbers, according to their backgrounds or behavior, and they were given the option to give a gift to our future generations, a genetic alteration that would make their descendants just a little bit better.
I look around at the others. Peter's mouth is puckered with disdain. Caleb is scowling.
Kara's mouth has fallen open, like she is hungry for answers and intends to eat them from the air.
Christina just looks skeptical, one eyebrow raised, and Tobias is staring at his shoes. I feel like I am not hearing anything new. Just the same philosophy that spawned the factions, driving people to manipulate their genes instead of separating into virtue-based groups. I understand it. On some level, I even agree with it. But I don't know how it relates to us, here, now.
But when the genetic manipulations began to take effect, the alterations had disastrous consequences. As it turns out, the attempt had resulted not in corrected genes, but in damaged ones, David says. Take away someone's fear, or low intelligence, or dishonesty, and you take away their compassion. Take away someone's aggression, and you take away their motivation, or their ability to assert themselves. Take away their selfishness, and you take away their sense of self-preservation. If you think about it, I'm sure you know exactly what I mean. I tick off each quality in my mind as he says it. Fear, low intelligence, dishonesty, aggression, selfishness. He is talking about the factions. And he's right to say that every faction loses something when it gains a virtue. The dauntless, brave but cruel, the erudite,
intelligent but vain. The Amity, peaceful but passive. The Candor, honest but inconsiderate. The Abnegation, selfless but stifling. Humanity has never been perfect, but the genetic alterations made it worse than it had ever been before. This manifested itself in what we call the Purity War, a civil war waged by those with damaged genes against the government and everyone with pure genes. The Purity War caused a level of destruction formerly unheard of on American soil, eliminating almost half of the country's population. "The visual is up," says one of the people at a desk in the control room. A map appears on the screen above David's head. It is an unfamiliar shape, so I'm not sure what it's supposed to represent, but it's covered with patches of pink, red, and dark crimson lights. "This is our country before the Purity War," David says, "and this is after." The lights start to recede, the patches shrinking like puddles of water drying in the sun. Then I realize that the red lights were people. People disappearing, their lights going out. I stare at the screen, unable to wrap my mind around such a substantial loss. David continues, "When the war was finally over, the people demanded a permanent solution to the genetic problem. And that is why the Bureau of Genetic Welfare was formed. Armed with all the scientific knowledge at our government's disposal, our predecessors designed experiments to restore humanity to its genetically pure state. They called for genetically damaged individuals to come forward so that the Bureau could alter their genes. The Bureau then placed them in secure environments to settle in for the long haul, equipped with basic versions of the serums to help them control their society. They would wait for the passage of time, for the generations to pass, for each one to produce more genetically healed humans, or, as you currently know them, the Divergent. Ever since Tori told me the word for what I am, Divergent, I have wanted to know what it means. And here is the simplest answer I have received. Divergent means that my genes are healed, pure, whole. I should feel relieved to know the real answer at last. But I just feel like something is off, itching in the back of my mind. I thought that Divergent explained everything that I am and everything that I could be. Maybe I was wrong. I am starting to feel short of breath as the revelations begin to work their way into my mind and heart. As David peels the layers of lies and secrets away, I touch my chest to feel my heartbeat, to try to steady myself. "Your city is one of those experiments for genetic healing, and by far the most successful one, because of the behavioral modification portion. The factions, that is." David smiles at us, like it's something we should be proud of. But I am not proud. They created us. They shaped our world. They told us what to believe. If they told us what to believe, and we didn't come to it on our own, is it still true? I press my hand harder against my chest. Steady. "The factions were our predecessors' attempt to incorporate a nurture element to the experiment. They discovered that mere genetic correction was not enough to change the way people behaved. A new social order, combined with the genetic modification, was determined to be the most complete solution to the behavioral problems that the genetic damage had created." David's smile fades as he looks around at all of us. I don't know what he expected. For us to smile back? He continues, "The factions were later introduced to most of our other experiments, three of which are currently active. We have gone to great lengths to protect you, observe you, and learn from you." Kara runs her hands over her hair, as if checking for loose strands. Finding none, she says, "So, when Edith Pryor said we were supposed to determine the cause of Divergence and come out and help you, that was..." "Divergent is the name we decided to give to those who have reached the desired level of genetic healing, says David. We wanted to make sure that the leaders of your city valued them. We didn't expect the leader of Erudite to start hunting them down, or for the abnegation to even tell her what they were. And contrary to what Edith Pryor said, we never really intended for you to send a divergent army out to us. We don't, after all, truly need your help. We just need your healed genes to remain intact and to be passed on to future generations.
So, what you're saying is that if we're not divergent, we're damaged?
Caleb says. His voice is shaking. I never thought I would see Caleb on the verge of tears because of something like this. But he is. Steady, I tell myself again, and take another deep, slow breath.
Genetically damaged, yes, says David. However, we were surprised to discover that the behavioral modification component of our city's experiment was quite effective. Up until recently, it actually helped quite a bit with the behavioral problems that made the genetic manipulation so problematic to begin with. So generally, you would not be able to tell whether a person's genes were damaged or healed from their behavior.
I'm smart, Caleb says.
So you're saying that because my ancestors were altered to be smart, I, their descendant, can't be fully compassionate? I, and every other genetically damaged person, am limited by my damaged genes, and the divergent are not.
Well, says David, lifting a shoulder. Think about it. Caleb looks at me for the first time in days, and I stare back. Is that the explanation for Caleb's betrayal? His damaged genes? Like a disease that he can't heal and can't control? It doesn't seem right.
Genes aren't everything, Amar says. People, even genetically damaged people, make choices. That's what matters.
I think of my father, a born erudite, not divergent, a man who cannot help but be smart, choosing abnegation, engaging in a lifelong struggle against his own nature, and ultimately fulfilling it, a man warring with himself, just as I war with myself. That internal war doesn't seem like a product of genetic damage. It seems completely, purely human. I look at Tobias. He is so washed out, so slouched, he looks like he might pass out. He's not alone in his reaction. Christina, Peter, Uriah, and Caleb all look stunned. Kara has the hem of her shirt pinched between her fingers, and she is moving her thumb over the fabric, frowning.
This is a lot to process, says David.
That is an understatement. Beside me, Christina snorts.
And you've all been up all night, David finishes, like there was no interruption. So, I'll show you to a place where you can get some rest and food.
Wait, I say. I think of the photograph in my pocket, and how Zoe knew my name when she gave it to me. I think of what David said, about observing us and learning from us. I think of the rows of screens, blank, right in front of me.
You said you've been observing us. How?
Zoe purses her lips. David nods to one of the people at the desks behind him. All at once, all the screens turn on, each of them showing footage from different cameras. On the ones nearest to me, I see Dauntless Headquarters, the Merciless Mart, Millennium Park, the Hancock Building, the Hub.
You've always known that the Dauntless observe the city with security cameras, David says.
Well, we have access to those cameras, too.
They've been watching us.
I think about leaving. We walk past the security checkpoint on our way to wherever David is taking us, and I think about walking through it again, picking up my gun and running from this place where they've been watching me since I was small. My first steps, my first words, my first day of school, my first kiss. Watching, when Peter attacked me, when my faction was put under a simulation and turned into an army, when my parents died. What else have they seen? The only thing that